Now, a biologist whose branch of research is sometimes regarded as obsolete, for this week's Science Out of the Box, we go into a lab full of spiders. Gustavo Ormiga is an arachnologist and a taxonomist. That's a scientist who discovers, classifies, and names life on Earth. It's one of the oldest fields of biology, but for a long time, it seemed a little fuddy-duddy and out of fashion. But in an age of climate change and growing habitat destruction, Gustavo Ormiga says taxonomy couldn't be more important.
We know the amounts of deforestation going on. You know that, you know, when they wipe out, you know, the slope of that mountain in the Andes, you know, there are a lot of things that live there that don't live anywhere else. If those species have not been collected, we would not even have the hard evidence that those species existed, right?
Yeah.
And that's going on now. We have extinction going at a massive scale, so it's extremely important to actually collect and document those species before they disappear.
Ormiga spends a good part of his year combing the forests of Australia, China, and North America for spiders. We caught up with him at his lab at George Washington University. We wanted to get a first-hand look at how a taxonomist goes about the daily grind of drawing new branches on the tree of life.
Okay, taxonomy 101.
Ormiga pulls out two female spiders from glass vials and places them under a microscope. They're members of the genus Orson Welles, and we'll have a bit more on the celebrity moniker later. Ormiga discovered them on the Hawaiian Islands.
What I'd like you to do is to see whether you can actually see any differences between the two of them.
Okay, so I'm looking at two Orson Welles spiders. They're both female. They're brown, kind of a nice amber color. With some white markings, but if we are looking at just the abdomen, it's actually quite easy because the one on the left has a kind of a carapace extending out on the abdomen, a little tiny cape, and the other one is not wearing a little tiny cape.
What I called a tiny cape, you think of something better. It's actually the epigenum. It's part of the female spider's reproductive system. And it turns out that these tiny differences in a spider's copulatory organs are often how scientists distinguish one species from another. Close-up drawings of spider parts lie scattered around Ormiga's lab. He personally sketches out every angle of the spiders he studies, inside and out. And to the untrained eye, these simple pencil drawings look like works of art.
And this is a detailed rendering of the many anatomical parts that make this copulatory organ. Locked in this anatomy, to a large extent, is the history of the evolution of the group. So if you understand, you know, the parts and what the comparisons are and the similarities and dissimilarities across species, you can uncover a lot about the evolutionary history.
Ormiga's constantly trying to figure out how one kind of spider relates to another and where they fit on the tree of life. For instance, about a decade ago, a colleague in Hawaii sent him some spiders from a bunch of different islands.
You know, from every different place was a different species. There was no branch in that particular part of the spider tree to accommodate this.
The missing branch on the spider tree intrigued Ormiga so much that he packed up his bags and went to Hawaii on a collecting spree. In the process, he discovered a whole new group, or genus, of spiders. This genus was notable because, compared to their closest relatives, these spiders were giant, and that's where the name came from.
If you like movies, you realize that Orson Welles was very unique. He was gigantic in a way in terms of movie making. These guys are very unique. They're also very gigantic. So I just said, okay, I'm going to name them Orson Welles.
Which one's Rosebud?
Huh? I don't have that one, but what I did is, for example, there is one species from Moankahili, which at the top has a radio tower. And then I remember his radio show of the
War of the Worlds.
And so I name it Orson Welles Bellum, from the Latin word for war, bellus.
And there's also Orson Welles Malus, for touch of evil, and Orson Welles Pilatus, that's a nod, of course, to Citizen Kane. To date, there are 12 known members of the Orson Welles genus, and by the way, giant, in this case, means about the size of a thumbtack. Overall, scientists like Ormega have named some 40,000 spiders so far, but they say there could be 110,000 more waiting to be named, and that number overwhelms Ormega.
This is intellectually an intoxicating experience. I mean, you'll find that most taxonomists, they really love their job. I'm here looking at things that nobody has ever seen before. I'm here, you know, describing how they look, describing how their life. You know, I'm going into those forests in Hawaii, you know, catching them. It has some sort of romantic side to it. Nobody ever before has seen this. And you get to see places that, unfortunately, you have to wonder at the end of the day whether a few decades from now are going to be there. So there is also kind of a moral obligation to do this.
Gustavo Ormega travels to Oregon and California next. Good thing spiders live in nice places. He'll collect spiders from a known family, but if he stumbles upon an unidentified spider, he's already been thinking of a name, Pink Floydia. Want to test your own taxonomy skills? Head to npr.org to see if you can tell the difference between two Orson Welles spiders.
If you're a woman who works at night, you could be at greater risk for breast cancer. And it turns out light could be the culprit.
Our regular medical expert is here with more. Dr. Sidney Spiesel is a Yale University faculty member, also a practicing pediatrician, and a regular here on our show. Hi, Sid.
Hi, Madeline.
So it's been known for some time that there is an association between breast cancer and night shift work, right?
Yes, absolutely. There are a number of studies that have supported that. The biggest one was a study of nurses, and the ones who spent a lot of time on night shift were at greater risk for breast cancer, for sure, compared to the ones who were mostly spent their time on day shift.
So now here comes this new study, I believe it's out of Israel, where scientists show that women who are exposed to a lot of nighttime light have higher rates of breast cancer?
Yeah. They took aerial maps at night of Israel that showed what areas had high light density, which are mostly cities, as you'd expect, and what parts of Israel were kind of dark at night. They compared that with maps of areas that had high frequency of breast cancer in women and areas that had low frequency. And sure enough, the two maps just lined up beautifully. The places where there was a lot of nighttime light, and presumably that means a lot of nighttime life activity, showed greater rates of breast cancer than the darker places.
And I suppose they excluded other factors, right? They controlled for other factors?
Well, yes. They did to the best they could. There are a lot of other factors that one might imagine. It's not just the difference between city and country is not just light. It's also stress. It's ethnicity. It's birth rate. It's average income. And they did as best they could to use statistical methods to filter out those confounding variables.
So what could be the possible explanation for this?
It may be related to a hormone called melatonin. Melatonin is produced by a gland deep in the brain. It's produced when we are in relative darkness, and it's released at much lower levels when we're in light. So at night, people's melatonin levels tend to be high, except if you're in a setting where there's a lot of bright light around you.
We have associated melatonin with sleep, right? I mean, this gives you a good night's sleep, is the production of melatonin.
Well, the melatonin probably doesn't directly cause sleep, but it may regulate other things that help us sleep. And so melatonin is often used by doctors to reset people's day-night clocks, for example. There's an interesting detail which, again, adds evidence to this whole thing. Women who are completely blind, who don't perceive light at all, have generally high circulating levels of melatonin day and night. And it doesn't actually affect their sleep very much, but it's interesting that these women have much lower rates of breast cancer than sighted women.
And Sid, this study, did it address all cancers or just breast cancer?
They compared breast cancer rates with nighttime illumination with lung cancer rates, and they found that the lung cancer rates were completely unrelated to the level of local illumination at night, whereas the breast cancer rates were very directly related. Now, none of this proves anything. You have to always keep in mind that we're seeing an association. These studies just show association and can't demonstrate causation, but they give you something to think about.
That's Dr. Sidney Spiesel. He's a Yale Medical School professor, and you can read his Medical Examiner column at Slate.com. Thanks, Sid.
Pleasure.
The region of the ocean, known as the Desert of the Sea, has expanded dramatically over the past decade, according to a new study. Scientists looking at the color of the ocean from space have found that vast areas that were once green with plankton have been turning blue as marine life becomes more scarce. If it's linked to global warming, as they suspect, this could be another blow for the world's fisheries. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Just as plants make up the base of the food web on land, tiny green phytoplankton in the ocean are a critical foodstuff for life in the oceans. And Jeff Polovina at a National Marine Fisheries Service lab in Hawaii has been watching by satellite as that greenery in the middle of the ocean is fading away.
The regions that are showing the lowest amount of plant life, which are sometimes referred to as the biological deserts of the ocean, are growing at roughly 1 to 4% per year.
1 to 4% may not sound like all that much, but these regions are huge to begin with. So this marine desert has grown by 2.5 million square miles in the past decade. That's an area the size of Texas every year. Polovina makes the analogy to deserts on land creeping into more productive environments.
Well, we have the same thing here. It's these less productive areas are replacing the slightly more productive areas of the ocean.
And it seems to be tied to global warming. His study in Geophysical Research Letters finds that the areas of low productivity are expanding in lockstep with increasing water temperatures. As surface temperatures warm, that prevents colder water from rising up from the depths, and that colder water carries the nutrients that would feed the algae. This kind of change is predicted by scientists studying climate change, but the sea desert has been spreading 10 times faster than the climate scientists predict, so Polovina is a bit cautious. He says this could be a short-term fluctuation, not a permanent change.
In the next 10 years, maybe it could switch back. Until we get a much longer time series, we don't know.
Whatever the case, the speed of change in the ocean is disturbing to marine scientists like Paul Falkowski at Rutgers University.
It is amazingly fast, if true.
And he says marine scientists using more primitive instruments from ships saw this trend starting long ago, back in the early days of the Industrial Revolution.
We can see that over 100 years, the ocean has gotten clearer and clearer in the center. So this is a long-term trend.
He, too, isn't sure that the trend will keep up at its current speed, but the long-term outlook is unsettling. He says the South Pacific is currently the clearest and least productive region of the Earth's oceans.
If we made the entire world's oceans like that, we'd probably reduce the productivity by at least a factor of two. And that would be extraordinarily large change, which I don't want to think about.
Fisheries, which are already under heavy stress from nets and lines, would suffer even more, he said. Reefs would suffer too. In all, the outlook for oceans is bleak. And we may not be fully aware of the situation as it changes. The satellite that made these critical measurements is nearing the end of its lifespan, and there's no full replacement in the works. So, in a few years, U.S. scientists may not be able to look at the color of the ocean from space to keep tracking this trend. Richard Harris, NPR News.
This weekend, we'll lose an hour of sleep but gain an hour of daylight as daylight saving time kicks in, at least in most of the country. But Matthew Kotchin is here to tell us if we think we're saving energy on daylight saving time, we should think again. Matthew Kotchin teaches economics at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And is that the assumption, Mr. Kotchin, that springing forward means we use less energy?
Yeah, it is the assumption that has carried through our energy policy here in the United States. And in fact, the original rationale was first put forth by Benjamin Franklin a long time ago and has carried through World War I, World War II.
You ended up doing a study in Indiana measuring energy consumption there. What did you find?
Well, we focused on Indiana because the unique history of the practice of daylight saving time there. And it turns out that for the several decades, many counties were not practicing daylight saving time, but some of them were. So this created what a social scientist call a natural experiment in order to estimate the effect of daylight saving time on energy consumption. And the reason why this arose was because the whole state changed to uniform application of the policy beginning in 2006. And so we collected data on 250,000 households and 7 million observations of monthly billing data. And we estimated that contrary to the conventional wisdom, daylight saving time actually increases electricity consumption rather than decreases it. And our estimates range between 1% and 4%.
And how much would that be in dollars, say, per household?
Based on very conservative estimates of the price of electricity that people pay in southern Indiana, it costs the average household $3.18 per year, which may not sound very much on a house-by-house basis, but if you aggregate it up to the population of Indiana, it turns out to be $8.6 million per year, and that's only the state of Indiana.
And what's the reason for that increase in energy use then?
What we found is that the Benjamin Franklin effect is, in fact, alive and well. But while Benjamin Franklin could foresee many things, he didn't necessarily foresee the prevalence of heating and cooling that we have today. And so there's a heating and cooling effect that runs in the opposite direction of the lighting effect. And what we're finding is that that effect, on balance, results in an increase in consumption rather than a decrease.
So that would mean what? We're turning on, if it's cold, we're turning on the heat earlier, and by contrast, we're using more air conditioning later in the day?
That's exactly right. And so if you are a household, say, that never changes your thermostat throughout the day, then daylight saving time would obviously have no effect on your electricity demand, and you might in fact get the savings from the lighting. But if you're a household that turns the heat down when you go to bed, when you wake up in the early spring and the late fall, daylight saving time is causing you to wake up at the coldest, darkest part of the day, and if you turn up your heat, you probably have to run your heat harder than you otherwise would have. At the same time, in the middle of the summer, you take an hour of sunlight from the early morning when you might have been sleeping and put it to the evening. And if that's a time when you really want your house to be cool in the evening, say when you're having dinner, you probably are going to be running your air conditioning stronger. And that explains the effect that we're finding.
And again, nothing that Ben Franklin would have factored in necessarily.
Well, Benjamin Franklin wouldn't have factored that in, although if I happened to be sitting next to Benjamin Franklin as he was talking about saving all the tallow and wax from not having to burn candles in the evening, I would have pointed out that he is probably using coal in order to heat the dwelling that he was in while he was doing it, and if he really wanted to consider the effect on energy, he should probably account for that as well.
Now, you're an economist, not a sociologist, so this may be unfair, but I would bet you would agree with me that there are huge social benefits to daylight saving time. If you have people out and about late in the day, sitting on their porches, seeing their neighbors, that's something that maybe you can't measure at all.
Yeah, even as an economist, I recognize the social benefits as well. And in fact, we talk about this quite a bit in our research and in our paper. But what we hope to come out of this study is at least, well, if we're going to pursue daylight saving time, then we should at least think about the fact that there may be an energy cost associated with it.
Okay, Matthew Kotchin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Matthew Kotchin of the University of California, Santa Barbara. Whether it saves energy or not, daylight saving time kicks in this Sunday at 2 a.m.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. We must begin this story by telling you what federal officials deny. They deny that they are in any way admitting that vaccines cause autism. The story, though, is about the reason they had to issue that denial. The government has agreed to award damages from a special vaccine compensation fund to the family of a girl with symptoms of autism. Autism activists are already using that case to back up their claims about vaccine dangers. Caught in the Crossfire is a program that is supposed to compensate families whose children suffer rare injuries that are definitively linked to vaccines. NPR's Julie Robner has more.
At a news conference on the steps of the federal courthouse in Atlanta yesterday, John Gilmore of the group Autism United pulled no punches.
For the first time, the court has conceded in a case that vaccines can indeed cause autism.
But federal officials say that's not what they've done. As part of a ruling that's supposed to be confidential, lawyers for the Department of Health and Human Services agreed to pay an as-yet undetermined amount from the Federal Vaccine Injury Compensation Program to the family of 9-year-old Hannah Poling. Hannah was developing normally until she received a series of shots when she was a year and a half old. After that, she began to regress and developed autistic-like symptoms. Further testing determined Hannah had an underlying disorder in her cells, a so-called mitochondrial disease, that can cause symptoms similar to autism. And in its ruling, the government said it was possible that the vaccines Hannah received may have exacerbated that disorder. Charles Mohan, CEO of the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation, says he finds the government's concession in this case reasonable.
It could have been the vaccine that exacerbated that particular underlying mitochondrial disease, or in a lot of cases, it's the onset of a virus, an infection, a flu that could have the same impact.
But at the same time, says Mohan, there's no scientific evidence to suggest that vaccines themselves can cause either mitochondrial disorders or autism. That's something federal public health officials stressed yesterday. Julie Gerberding heads the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Government has made absolutely no statement indicating that vaccines are a cause of autism. That is a complete mischaracterization of the findings of the case and a complete mischaracterization of any of the science that we have at our disposal today.
But that remains a hard sell to parents of autistic children like Becky Estep of Poway, California. She says the reaction her son Eric had to a hepatitis B vaccine in 1998 was immediate and severe. Not only did he begin to suffer a myriad of physical problems.
At the same time, his speech wasn't developing as much any longer, and he kind of withdrew from our world and turned into himself.
Symptoms like those led Estep and other autism activists to search for a vaccine autism link. Many think that link may be the preservative thimerosal, a mercury derivative no longer used in most vaccines. Now Estep represents one of nearly 5,000 families of children with autism who've filed for damages from the Federal Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. That's nearly twice as many families as the program has compensated since its inception 2 decades ago, and most of those awards were for well-documented side effects that occur in a small number of cases, things like getting polio from the oral polio vaccine. Paying claims to all those children with autism would quickly bankrupt the program.
There's no question this is the biggest challenge to the vaccine compensation system that it's ever seen.
That's California Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman. He wrote the law that created the vaccine compensation system in 1988. He says the program is threatened no matter what happens. If the families of the autistic children win compensation, there won't be enough money to pay all their bills. But if compensation is denied those families, he says, they'll probably go to court instead.
Which could scare off the manufacturers from deciding to even stay in this business.
Vaccine manufacturers won't say that outright, but they voice another worry, that if the vaccine program awards money to families for autism, other parents might be afraid to vaccinate their children. Thomas Netzer is with drug and vaccine maker Merck.
In fact, there'd be a real risk, I believe, that diseases which have been controlled in the United States and which used to cause very high morbidity and mortality, in fact, thousands of deaths every year, could once again become common in the United States. That would not be a good outcome.
With the government's concession in the Georgia case, it won't have a formal hearing, but a total of 9 other test cases are being heard by the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, testing various theories of whether vaccines alone, thimerosal alone, or a combination of the two could cause autism. It could be a year before all those cases are decided. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
The Grand Canyon is getting a bath. Earlier today, Secretary of the Interior Dirk Kempthorne helped unleash an enormous man-made flood from the Glen Canyon Dam into the Colorado River.
The flooding will go on for 60 hours. It's meant to replenish the river's dwindling beaches and backwaters and help save the canyon's endangered humpback chub fish.
Just how much water does it take to flush the Grand Canyon? Try 41,500 cubic feet per second. According to Secretary Kempthorne, that's enough to fill the Empire State Building with water in about 20 minutes. But so far as we know, there's no plan to do that.